And I'd like now to introduce Kate Perry. She is a dog trainer, and she's author of the book Training for Both Ends of the Leash. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, great to be here.
Now, this is a whole guide not only to training your dog, but training for your specific dog and also for your specific life. One of the things that we dog owners really need to learn to do is to understand dogs' language. What are some of the, and of course their language is primarily nonverbal. What are some of the pieces of their language that it would really behoove us to understand?
There's quite a bit, actually, but to simplify it and sort of put it into some user-friendly terms, some of the most basic that I think people see in the dog runs all the time are the shaking, the digging, the walking off from each other. But what I've laid out in the book is to fine-tune some of this that people tend to miss. There's some licking, there's yawning, there's the shaking off, and this is what we call calming signals and displacement behaviors. And this is some of the dog language that dogs are interacting with each other all the time. And the three most basic are called calming signals, displacement behaviors, and cutoff signals. So a calming signal in a dog is when they're licking, not licking each other, but when their lips are just sort of, you know, licking their own mouth, sort of. And actually that is a signal to calm the other dog down. And also yawning is another signal and a behavior that dogs do that we attribute to just being bored or over it because, you know, sometimes we humanize that.
Right.
And actually that's another behavior that's actually calming the situation down. A lot of dogs, when they're stressed, they'll yawn a lot. Those are some of the basic behaviors that sometimes people miss and don't understand. And obviously as a behaviorist and trainer, you know, these are things that we learn and learn to watch for with the dogs. Obviously like a tail wagging in a relaxed position and the ears forward and there's a relaxed mouth, that's a signal that the dog's pretty content. Tail down is usually the dog's, you know, afraid or nervous about something. So those are the basics that people, you know, mostly see in dog runs. Old school, they used to just watch the dog's tail, but actually there's a lot more to it. There's a lot of facial expressions, these licking, the yawning, the turning the head away when another dog is meeting one dog and the dog actually wants to back the other one off. They'll turn the head to the side, and that's called a cutoff signal, and also under the umbrella of calming signals. So that's some of what goes on.
You also write about the four drives that dogs have: pack, prey, fight, and flight. And we certainly all, as human beings, we know fight and flight, and we understand predatory drives, and we see dogs, and probably ourselves too, as pack animals. Do all dogs have all four of those, or are some of them dominant one kind or another?
Yeah, I mean, there's other drives too. There's also play drives, and, you know, but drives is a terminology that trainers and behaviorists have used for a long time in dogs, like what drives the dog to do something. Dogs, centuries ago, were used to work for us. Their primal instincts were what we wanted them to work off of, which is basically, you know, chase and go and get the ferret, right? Go and hunt and get me that bird. So the drives that we're talking about in the book is just to remind people that dogs, originally, their natural genetic disposition is sort of coming from a primal state. Now, we've domesticated dogs, and they don't really need to operate off of, we don't want them to operate off their fight and their hunting, their prey drive, so to speak. But they come with that. A lot of them come with that natural genetic disposition. So what I'm laying out in the book is, just remind people that we tend to overhumanize dogs and put so much of our own emotions on them. But at the end of the day, sometimes when they're kind of pissing us off, if you will, sometimes they're just operating off a natural instinct. So what we're trying to do with the training is, if I've got a, let's say, like a Jack Russell, right? They're known as a breed to want to go and chase and hunt and get things, right? So the chasing the ball and fetching is the standard of that type of breed, but not every Jack Russell is going to be the perfect one at doing that. So when you understand that that's the need of that dog, because what happens in my profession is that I go in and they say, oh, he looks so cute. He's so cute as a puppy. But the Jack Russell is going to come with a strong work ethic, like work hard, party hard kind of guy.
Right.
So you've got to be prepared that generally that breed type is going to come with a strong prey drive. And if it's not properly socialized and trained, that can turn into a fight drive too. Now, also, what I've done is added their personality type with it, their character trait, if you will. You know, every human, you know, we're all of the same species as a human race, but we all have our own soul and identity with that, right? In the sense of, like, we all have our own personality trait. And that gets shaped on how, well, one, our genetic disposition, and two, how we've been raised and how we've been shaped. So dogs get that too. And so what I'm saying with the drives is that they come with these sort of four prominent basic drives for survival. So dogs actually have three ways of dealing with fear. They either fight, they flight, or they freeze, as do we and most animals, right? Fear induces either like a reaction to face off and argue the point, or retreat and shut down. Most of the time I'm going into sessions and people go, oh, my dog is stupid. Oh, he doesn't know anything. And actually, when I set off, let's say, prey drive to chase something, it actually brings out a little bit of the dogginess that people tend to stuff sometimes. And I'm always about, like, letting the dog be a dog, but obviously in a safe, controlled environment.
I remember when I have two Jack Russell Terriers, and one of them was having some real problems. She looked fat and depressed, and she was very unhappy. And so I got her a puppy, which ended up being another Jack Russell Terrier. And a friend of mine put it nicely. He said, milk brings out the dog in honey. She started acting more like a dog, and she lost weight and became much happier. And it was very interesting because she really needed another dog and doggy things that I couldn't give her.
Right, right. Which is, you're lucky, actually, that that happened, because that doesn't always happen. Although my experience as a trainer is mostly in the urban environment, urban dog training as opposed to suburban dog training. And very often I find that in the city that doesn't always work out, because sometimes that's the roommate they didn't ask for. If they're getting, like, number one attention from their owners, and then they get another dog coming into play. But you're an example of the breed type that needs a lot of stimulus. So that's great. Do they play with each other?
Oh, yeah. And they play outside, and they run together, and they sort of chase things together, and they hunt together, and things like that.
Excellent. So they sort of feed off each other, and it sounds like in your case, in a positive way. Very often in the city, what I found is just because there's a lot of leash tension, because people are living in apartments, and then going down the elevator, and then the lobby, there's a lot of obstacles before they get outside. And so when the dogs are interplaying with each other, it's all leash-related. So there's a lot of tension from the owners coming from that. So it can actually exasperate some of the dog-on-dog interaction. And this is what I call leash frustration rather than just leash aggression, which often gets mislabeled sometimes. And then sometimes when you get the second dog, that adds more fuel to that fire.
We're talking to Kate Perry about her book, Training for Both Ends of the Leash. Now, you alluded to the dog personality types, and I just found it so fascinating because people love to compartmentalize themselves into personality types, like introvert and extrovert, or Aquarius, or whatever, type A, or there's so many different personality typings. And then you have these dog personality types, or caninality, as you call it, and they're terrific, and they really do seem to apply. What are the four?
Well, the four that I've laid out in the book are, we've got the workaholic, we've got the party animal, we've got the sensitive artist, and then we've got the methodical thinker.
Right.
Of course, there can be others, but those are the prominent that everybody can identify with that. And when I go into sessions with people and their dogs, because obviously, as titled in the book, Training for Both Ends of the Leash, I'm training you as a dog owner to train your dog. So what I found over the years of doing this is that, yes, of course, they've got their primal instincts from which they're operating, but they've also got their own little character traits. And when I've got, like, the stereotypical party animal, the image that comes to mind to most people is that yellow lab, the golden retriever wagging its tail. Somebody comes in the door, you can see them smiling, and they're saying hi to everybody, and that tail's going. You know, when you've got that, when I've helped people understand, oh, you actually have a dog that's, like, really engaged and wants to be part of the world, you've got to train that personality type as well, not just the breed type. And that dog may not want to go and retrieve. Their reinforcement is going to be more just a pat on the head and a belly rub. So understanding this party animal type that just wants a lot of attention praise is a huge factor on how to reinforce that dog, right? So it doesn't just have to be treat-based training for that dog. So that's how you could modify your training, understanding, like, oh, it doesn't have to be cookie-cutter approach. Whereas if you've got the Jack Russell type, I keep using that example, or Border Collie or German Shepherd, workaholic, right? Just get the job done. Stop petting me. Tell me what to do.
Right.
And people are like that, too. That's where that type A personality comes in. Just write it down. Tell me what to do. And when you understand that your dog is that type, owners can be a better trainer for their dog. They have greater insight to their own dog as opposed to just going, he won't listen to me. Well, because you're talking to him too much. He doesn't want the belly rub. He wants to be told what to do. And then when we've got the methodical thinker, those dogs, when you're training them, they're thinking before they do. And Rottweilers, German Shepherds fit that bill. When you have that image of that dog, if you know dogs and you look at those dogs, you can almost hear them thinking before they do something. But you can have a Havanese that has that trait too.
So the different personality traits are not totally, sometimes they're breed specific, but sometimes they're really not. And if you're going to get a dog, you have to look carefully to kind of figure out what kind of a dog it is, because presumably it might make sense to get a dog that fits your personality and lifestyle.
Absolutely. And that's the whole point of this book. And that's where breeders and shelters and anybody that's sort of placing a dog in a home should really be a part of this. And this is what I'm hoping that this book can do, is sort of help them assess, go, oh, we've got a real sensitive artist, background dog, doesn't want to be center of attention, little bit timid. That actually works quite well with a person that doesn't want to socialize too much. Although I'm big on socializing the dogs, don't get me wrong, because we want good behaviors in them. But the more gentle, relaxed personality, as opposed to just breed type. And I think what so many owners or potential owners get caught up in is like, oh, that one looks good. I want one of those. Or I saw a Wheaton Terrier in somebody's home and he was so sweet, blah, blah, blah. I want one of those. Well, you may not get that character trait in that dog. You may get the worker that needs to run all day. And it's also to have a bit more fun with the training process. Because I'm getting called in when things are not working. I'm getting called in when they're either at their wit's end or just want to enhance their relationship and get more insight. And the biggest sort of classic thing that I get is like, oh, my dog's not very bright. And I haven't met one yet that isn't that bright. It's more to do with their caninality, their personality type, and the matchup between them and the owner. And I'm getting a little bit more insight in what's going to turn that dog on.
Many of us have adopted dogs who were traumatized, rescue dogs, and we certainly encourage people on this program to adopt dogs from the shelter, and they do a wonderful job over at the shelter. We were just talking to them. But it remains that sometimes a characteristic will come out, like an aggressive trait will come out, that a dog, little dog, will start biting. How do you understand that, first of all, and then how do you help to get over that?
Yeah. Well, the first thing is my hat is off to these shelters because they have a big job because you can't properly assess each dog that is getting homed from a shelter. They do their basic temperament assessments usually on like whether they're food bowl guarding or whether they've had a history of biting. And when you've got a dog that's coming into a shelter that you have no history on, and this is what we had with Tucker, who's featured on the cover of the book, we had no history on him. The first few weeks, he was sweet as a lamb. He just did not show any signs of anything. Then guess what? He woke up about 3 weeks in and turned into a little tyrant. It's like the shell shock of like, I don't know what my place is in the world because I've been like from shelter to shelter or rehomed or who knows what. So I always say to people when they call me with their rescue dogs and they go, I want it trained and I want to teach sit and lie down, stay or whatever. I say, actually, don't be fooled. The first month is probably not the real true layers of that dog. They'll probably come out like 3 to 6 weeks later. So when they start exhibiting, you know, wanting to nip and bite, first of all, I say get a trainer in ASAP and properly assess it within the dynamics of the household. If it becomes food bowl aggression, a lot of that is workable, but you need a professional to help guide you. And you can never punish. Punishment does not treat that kind of aggression. You have to be very careful. And I always say that, if you think about it, treating aggression with aggression isn't going to solve the aggression.
We need to learn that on an international scale, too.
Yeah. It's a big challenge for a lot of us positive reinforcement trainers when we've got, you know, some of them using like pin downs and all this stuff. But on a very basic level, I think all shelters should be working with a group of trainers that work with people in their homes so that we can keep those shelter dogs in those homes.
But in other words, if a dog is exhibiting behaviors like that, how do you train them out of it? I mean, you're the professional.
You've got to get a proper assessment on it first. Get a professional in. If it's low, what I call low-level food bowl aggression, where they just growl a little bit when you come near the food bowl, then I would just start by not leaving free food down and hand-feeding the dog for I can't really put a timeline on it, but 2 to 6 week hand-feeding at all times. Start teaching the dog that the hand that feeds the dog is a good thing, and that you own the food bowl, and then he holds the food bowl in front of the dog, and then you hand-feed it from the food bowl. That's one little example. But it's very workable if I can get the owner compliance on it. And so if I see the potential in the dog, then it's our job as trainers to help motivate the owner to want to do it.
Did you ever meet a dog that you just couldn't train, that was too far gone?
There's been a couple, but then these dogs had neurological issues. They were having seizures, and they had a ton of medical issues that were adding fuel to the fire. And one was having seizures, and when he would go into the seizure and then come out of a seizure, he would just become really violent with his aggression. And
goodness,
there were children in the house, and yes, you know what? It was really unpleasant for the dog. He was so stressed, he was just so disoriented and distraught by it because he didn't even know where he was, and he would just attack everything.
Now, our dogs, when I look at them, I see that our dogs are often trying to understand us as much as we're trying to understand them. So how do we dog owners make our verbal and our body language really clear so that we're really speaking to each other?
Right. Yeah, that's a great topic to bring up. This is the whole adage of less is more. Stop talking to your dog so much is what I'd say to the people out there. Keep it succinct, precise, and decisive. It's that whole mean what you say and don't say it mean. Have an authoritative tone and then follow it up with what you want and don't say it over and over and over again. So just a little example. If you want your dog to sit, help it along with a lure if you need to. Put one physical gesture over the dog's head, like if you're sort of luring it with a treat over its nose and then bringing it over the forehead and sort of luring it back. Keep it very still and succinct, as opposed to lots of movement and repetitions. And I always say with kids, when I'm training kids with dogs, stand like a tree. Trees don't move, right? So you're going to lure the dog into position, and then as the dog does the behavior, say it once. One command, one gesture, and a couple of treats after they do it. And let me just say, trainers had to be trained too. We go into this having our little habits and our physical gestures and this. And when I've got the party animal owner, that's a toughie. That's always a challenge because they want to clap and they want to raise their hands up and they're always going, yay, you know, all that kind of excited. They're so happy for the dog that they just did something. Sometimes it's almost too much for the dog that's trying to learn.
Now, here's a question that may not come up very much when you're training dogs in places like New York City, but here in New Mexico, for example, outside of my house, there's always coyotes coming up the acequia. So the dogs, when they hear it, they go bananas and they run outside their dog doors and they go to the fence and bark. And one of them has learned to howl and he howls. What is the right thing to do in that situation?
Well, do they have free access to their backyard?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's always a challenge because you don't know when the coyote is going to show up. From a trainer's point of view, I wouldn't let the dog have free access to sort of getting out there and controlling the environment unless you need it to. Obviously, I mean, this is going back to like what we used to breed dogs for as guard dogs and protecting us. But if you don't need that, I would control the environment first. And then I would teach the dog where to go, like have its place. Always have a containment area for your dog, whether it be behind a gated off area and a safe den, or the crate used as a safe den, not as a punishment. But I would teach the dog that it's not their job to do that. I mean, we get the same issue, believe it or not, in New York when people are, the delivery guys knocking at the door And the dog's like, rawr, 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 you know, invasion to my territory, invasion to my territory. A lot of these dogs, right? The first thing I teach this dog, come back to me with a touch target. You want to start teaching the dog that there's a reward in coming back to you, that the reward is not getting off and taking care of business.
Now, is there a time when our human perception of how cute they are just gets in the way, like we just put too much emphasis on that?
Oh, yes. Especially the little fluff balls, right, that look like toys, but they're not. And this dog comes with the gene of dog and that primal instincts that we go back to, which is the pack, prey, fight, and flight, and the genetic disposition to chase and to fight or to flight if they're in fear. And that gets genetically modified and put into a little white fluff ball, like a little coton de Tulier. And then they make these fun little names for them, right? Little French name. The other little white fluffy dog is what I call it. Yeah, but they've got strong personalities, right? So that's when we come back to the caninality part. Like, let's look at let's look at the prominent drive of that dog. That's where I was going back to earlier, that I've got plenty of Havanese that have, like, a huge work ethic and don't want to be petted all the time, want to be told what to do. And so that cutesy factor is a big trap. Always work them, is my opinion. Make them work for their food, make them, like, get a hollow, sterilized bone, put the food in it, make them work for it. Give them something to do. They don't have enough to do, most of these dogs.
Now, do you have any tips for owners who have multiple dogs? Should you try to train more than one at a time, or do you have to separate them while you train them?
That's a great thing to bring up, by the way, because I deal with that a lot. Being that every dog is different, and I've got a client that actually has 5 retrievers and a pit bull mix. And yes, if you want to stereotype the retriever-type dog to be the party animal, right, tail wagging, everybody's cool, these 6 retrievers have completely different personalities. One's a sensitive artist, right? One's more of the workaholic, the athlete. Train them separately. Work on each dog separately. I would say take a week on each dog to really fine-tune each command in each dog, and then you can put it all together. If you train them together, you're setting yourself up for regression, because one's going to learn one way because of their learning ability. And usually when I've got the worker, the one that's front row seat, like type A+ student is what I call them. I'm here, I'm there, I'm ready to work. Certainly with a pack of dogs, if they're the first one in, like, ready to go, I usually make them wait. I work on impulse control on that one. And then the more sensitive one I'll bring out to the front just to sort of equalize the pack a little bit.
And so when you're training one, you have to put the other one in a different room with the door closed, presumably.
Yep. Yeah. Or you put one in the crate. Like, it depends what the setup is in each household. You put one in the crate while you're training the other, and then cover the crate so that they're not feeling left out. But I always give a dog, like the whole adage, give a dog a bone. And real bones are good for dogs. Real raw bones are okay. The femur of the cow is okay to give your dog. The raw chicken bone, not so much, probably, for a lot of dogs. But, like, or give the dog a chew toy. Give the dog a chew bone while the other one's working so that they're getting occupied.
Kate Perry is a dog trainer and author of the book Training for Both Ends of the Leash. And I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe, and maybe we'll have you again talking about more dog issues.
Oh, I would love to, and it's been an absolute pleasure, and I hope this has been somewhat helpful to some of the listeners out there.
And the website is kateperrydogtraining.com, and I will link to that on my website.